he said he got the impression that Tolkachev was alone when he openly spoke about how to get to the site. In previous calls, Tolkachev had been much more circumspect. Gilscher also noted that Tolkachev sounded like a layman, and definitely not a member of the KGB. Tolkachev followed instructions to signal the CIA that he had received the construction mitten. In September, the Dear Gramps letters arrived successfully from Tolkachev. All three showed signs of having been opened by the KGB, but the secret writing had gone undetected. The letters squelched any doubts at headquarters. Each carried encrypted material, largely technical in nature, responding to the CIA's questions with information that was consistent both with earlier intelligence and with Tolkachev's claims of access to top-secret documents. The letters included intelligence on a new Soviet airborne radar and guidance system, the results of performance tests of new Soviet aircraft radar systems, and the status of work on weapons aiming equipment for various Soviet aircraft. The secret writing and one-time pad had been executed perfectly. The CIA realized that they were dealing with an organized, precise person who followed instructions, a genuine volunteer with great potential. Tolkachev also sent them a tantalizing hint. He had a 91-page notebook crammed full of information he wanted to deliver. With the arrival of the secret writing letters, the CIA had successfully carried out a clandestine exchange with the agent, but it was cumbersome, and they still lacked a long-term plan for communications. Hathaway was eager to press ahead. He wanted to end the stand-down once and for all. He proposed to headquarters that they carry out a personal meeting, a method that would allow the CIA to examine more deeply what the agent could do and what he wanted. In a cable to headquarters, Hathaway and Gilscher proposed repeating the August routine with the construction mitten, calling Tolkachev, but this time meeting him by the telephone booth. They would ask him to bring the notebook. Gilscher would conduct a walking meeting with Tolkachev and stroll toward the Moscow River. A big advantage was that the area was dark and fairly deserted at night. On November 4th, headquarters came around to Hathaway's suggestion of a personal meeting, the primary purpose of which is to find out just who C.K. Sphere is, what precisely he wants, and to negotiate the terms, means, and general parameters of our continued cooperation. Turner approved the plan on November 21st. This effectively marked the end of the stand-down, more than a year after it began. The hope was that a meeting would lead to a long-term channel for keeping in touch with Tolkachev. But Hathaway still faced difficulties. Gilscher was being subjected to increased surveillance, and he might not be available for the personal meeting. The Moscow station also wanted to provide more detailed questions for Tolkachev, and headquarters agreed. Much would depend on how Tolkachev answered the questions, which probed his living and job situations, family, privacy at home and work, vacation plans, hobbies, security, health, whether he owned a camera and a radio, access to classified documents, description of his office desk, what equipment he worked on, names of supervisors, and what journals he had access to. Finally, they were almost ready. A last step was to inform the U.S. Ambassador, Malcolm Toon. The ambassador didn't like the idea. If the meeting blew up, it could be embarrassing. But Hathaway persuaded him it was necessary. Chapter 5. A Dissident at Heart. On New Year's Day, 1979, Moscow was locked in the grip of a frigid cold wave. Windows frosted over, cars would not start, and the streets were nearly deserted. John Gilscher noticed that KGB surveillance had almost completely disappeared, perhaps because of the holiday and the numbing cold. He decided this would be the day. From their apartment, John and Kisa drove their daughter Anya to a birthday party at the U.S. Embassy compound. When it was over, about 5:30 p.m., with the city already shrouded in darkness, they headed home. Not far from the apartment, they stopped the car. John silently got out from behind the wheel and disappeared down a narrow lane. As he left the car, he was dressed in a plain overcoat and fur hat, looking like a Russian pensioner, unremarkable in the night. Kisa drove home. Gilshier boarded a bus and then got off at a metro stop close to Tolkachev's apartment, the same location where they had placed the construction mitten in August. He examined the broad open area and saw no one watching him. His radio earpiece, set to monitor any transmissions from the KGB, was quiet. Gilshier went to a phone booth and placed a call to Tolkachev. Gilshier introduced himself as Nikolai and asked Tolkachev to come at once and bring the materials. 15 minutes later, Tolkachev appeared. He was neatly dressed, somewhat shorter than Gilshier, with a long oval face, slightly jutting jaw, a rugged appearance, and a few gold or silver teeth. Calm and disciplined, Tolkachev did not look around nervously. He kept to the subject they were discussing and answered questions clearly. When Gilshier asked if he brought the notebook, Tolkachev slipped it out of his coat. Normally, Gilshier carried a briefcase, but he left it at home, thinking that on a holiday it would look out of place. Gilshier tucked the notebook under his belt and felt the sting of icy air on his midriff. Then he asked Tolkachev the question that had nagged at them all. What was his motive for taking such a big risk? Tolkachev replied, hesitantly, that it was a complex question, one that would require a lot of time to discuss. Gilshier prodded him again. Why? Tolkachev responded only that he was a dissident at heart. Then Tolkachev had a question for Gilshier. He wanted to know how much the United States had paid Belenko, the MiG-25 pilot who defected to Japan in 1976. Gilshier had anticipated the question. He said he didn't know how much Belenko had been paid, but offered Tolkachev 1,000 rubles a month for his cooperation. Tolkachev asked Gilshier for 10,000 rubles for his work so far. Gilshier said it would be no problem, and gave Tolkachev 1,000 rubles. It was a ridiculously small sum, perhaps three times the monthly salary of a mid-career Soviet academic, while the intelligence Tolkachev had already provided was worth tens of millions of dollars to the United States. Gilshier gave Tolkachev some additional questions to answer next time they met. Gilshier cautioned Tolkachev that money had often been the undoing of agents. He recalled the 1977 arrests of two agents in Moscow, which had been written about in the newspapers, saying it was because of money. This was stretching the truth. They were arrested for other reasons, but Gilshier thought it might give Tolkachev second thoughts. Besides, Gilshier said, there was not much to buy in Moscow, which was plagued by shortages. Tolkachev acknowledged the risk, saying he would be careful and sensible. He told Gilshier his family did not really need more money. He could explain any cash as part of an inheritance from his mother, who had died recently. Gilshier got the distinct impression that Tolkachev wanted money as a sign of respect, to show that his efforts were valued. The streets were empty as they walked, two men in overcoats, speaking quietly, enveloped in Russia's winter darkness. Their words were terse and to the point. Gilshier, who had never before been a case officer on the street, wanted to get it right. He asked Tolkachev if he had a private office where he could use a camera to photograph documents. No, Tolkachev said, but if he had a camera that was relatively quiet, he could probably linger at the office at the end of the workday, perhaps for 20 or 30 minutes until the doors were locked, and photograph documents. Gilshier was impressed with the answer. It showed Tolkachev knew his limits and how not to raise suspicions. Tolkachev said a camera would relieve him from writing up so much by hand. Gilshier promised to deliver a camera soon. Tolkachev said he had absolutely no privacy in his apartment. The family telephone was in the kitchen, and his wife or son often answered. There were only two other rooms. He confessed he had spent hours waiting by the phone for Nikolai to call. When he needed to work in private on the 91-page notebook, he had retreated to the Lenin Library, the largest public library in Moscow, hunching over the notebook for hours, alone. For 40 minutes, they walked and talked in the biting cold. Gilscher sensed it was time to part. They shook hands, and Tolkachev disappeared into the night. Gilscher took the bus toward home, the notebook still tucked into his belt. He uttered not a word about the meeting to Kisa, and went to bed with the notebook under his mattress. The next day, he carried it to the station. The first thing he did was send a cable to headquarters that the meeting had come off without surveillance and that he had given Tolkachev 1,000 rubles and additional questions. Gilscher wrote, "There were no untoward incidents. C.K. Sphere handed over 91 pages of what I think will be invaluable intelligence." Then, in a longer cable, Gilscher described the meeting. Gilscher said he was highly impressed by the coolness and professional behavior of Tolkachev. On a day when the average Soviet was somewhat inebriated, he appeared to be absolutely sober, Gilscher wrote. Tolkachev had allowed Gilscher to steer the direction of their conversation and appeared to accept him as an expert in whose hands he placed his future safety. As case officer, Gilscher's entire focus was on the operational details, such as communications, meetings, and planning. The positive intelligence, the information about Soviet military radars and other matters contained in Tolkachev's 91-page handwritten notebook, was rushed directly to headquarters, where it was translated and carefully analyzed. Immediately, headquarters had reservations about the money, unsettled by the prospect of Gilscher delivering wads of cash. What Gilscher had told Tolkachev was certainly true. A trail of money had often led agents to be careless and cause their own downfalls. Gilscher reassured headquarters on January 22nd that Tolkachev was keenly aware of the dangers and agreed to warn him again at their next meeting. During the walk, Gilscher said, he raised with Tolkachev the possibility of a hard currency escrow account in his name in the West. This would be safer, but Tolkachev brushed it off, saying he would never have any use for it. Gilscher urged headquarters not to renege on the 10,000 rubles he had promised. They still had to earn Tolkachev's trust. "At this point, we feel it is essential to live up to our arrangement and pass him the requested sums," he wrote to headquarters. "By delivering the money promptly," he added, "we hope to instill in him a complete trust in us, and once he is confident we will live up to our part of the bargain, we can begin to probe delicately to try to resolve this ticklish topic." Gilscher suggested they wait 6 months before bringing it up again. The first meeting touched off a flurry of activity. Now, at last, the Moscow station was back in the espionage business. Every action of human intelligence collection, putting down a dead drop, such as the construction mitten with secret writing hidden inside, or making a call from a phone, or writing an operations note to an agent, or preparing sites for meetings and signals, demanded intense preparation by the station and frequent cables back and forth to headquarters. Running a spy was undertaken with the concentration and attention to detail of a moonshot. Neither the station nor headquarters wanted to leave anything to chance. Not even the smallest nut or bolt could be out of place. Photographs and maps were prepared of each site. Surveillance detection runs plotted. Scenarios scripted and rehearsed. And the question was asked again and again, what could go wrong? Gilscher had to speak up for the agent in the back and forth with headquarters, become a friend and confessor to the agent, serve as the agent's advisor and protector, provide equipment, training, money, and feedback, become the trusted face of the CIA and the United States to someone who had never set foot in America, and all of this with a man he hardly knew. Every case officer worked with the realization that no agent was ever completely knowable. They behaved in unpredictable ways, often beyond the control of their handlers. Gilcher's next move was to write a personal letter for a package they would deliver to Tolkachev in February. He drafted the letter in a way that he hoped would be unambiguous, praising Tolkachev as reliable and calm, expressing confidence that you will always act sensibly, that it will be possible to count on you to observe the instructions in the communications plan, and that you will calmly fulfill the role that you have chosen. Then Gilcher shifted tone to that of coach, saying that Tolkachev must strive to not attract attention in any way. He explained, "One has to look and behave like the average person on the street, in the office, not to show too much interest in the work of others, not to request materials from the first department which are not connected with your work, and not to work late too often, i.e., stay in the office by yourself." The first department was the repository in Soviet research institutes for top-secret documents, and also a security office for keeping watch on workers and controlling clearances for access to the secret materials. Further, Gilcher instructed, "In your private life, it is important to establish a pattern of life that will cover our contacts and will not arouse suspicion at home. Mainly, it is necessary to act calmly and not to rush." Gilcher appealed to Tolkachev to share with me at any time any thoughts which you cannot discuss with your wife and friends. He urged the spy to speak up if there was anything that worried him. He closed the letter, "I shake your hand, Nikolai." On February 17, 1979, Gilcher went on a surveillance detection run and, free from the KGB, laid down a package for Tolkachev to pick up. Once again, the package was hidden in the dirty construction mitten. This time it contained one miniature camera, known as a Molly, a light meter, film, camera instructions and operations note, the personal letter from Gilcher, an evaluation note from CIA headquarters, further questions or requirements from the CIA, a communications plan, and 5,000 rubles, or half what Tolkachev had requested for his work so far. The evaluation was upbeat, but not specific, saying the secret writing letters had been prepared with fine technique and the information very well received. The 91-page January notebook showed painstaking effort and dedication, and the CIA was very impressed. But the evaluation stopped short of details, except for one. Tolkachev was given a very specific request, to obtain any information he could about a radar known as the RP-23. This would be of utmost value. In March, a cable from the Moscow station to headquarters noted that Tolkachev was now fully operational. But the CIA's agent and his case officer were still finding their way. Gilcher had instructed Tolkachev on the procedure for confirming an impromptu meeting. Under the plan, the CIA provided Tolkachev with a set of quick meeting sites, locations that were close to his apartment building. Each was given a Russian code name, such as Ninochka. The plan was that Gilcher would call Tolkachev's home phone and ask for Ninochka, signaling a desire to meet at that site. If he could come on short notice, Tolkachev would say the caller must have a wrong number and hang up, then go out the door. However, when Gilcher made the first phone call one day in February, asking for Ninochka, Tolkachev made an error. "Is this Nikolai calling?" he said. That wasn't the right answer. Gilcher hung up. Gilcher tried again on the evening of April 4th, asked for Valery, and this time it worked. Tolkachev was out the door quickly. They met for 15 minutes at site Valery and traded packages. Tolkachev gave Gilcher 5 cassettes of exposed 80-frame film from the Molly miniature camera, 56 pages of handwritten materials, including a long letter to the CIA, and 4 sketches. 7 days later, headquarters sent Hathaway and Gilcher a hint that Tolkachev's material was impressive. "You will be interested to know," the cable said, "that the material from the January package had been formally distributed in a document over 100 pages in length. And initial reaction from the Air Force is highly enthusiastic, and the material is clearly having a significant impact. In fact, the January notebook had contained a rich harvest of secrets. Tolkachev had included a detailed description of the sensitive work in which he was involved, as well as exact formulas, diagrams, drawings, and specifications of weapons and electronic systems. He copied by hand top-secret documents, authorizing the construction of new types of aircraft, not yet known in the West, such as the Sukhoi Su-27 advanced fighter. He had carefully drawn various diagrams on oversized graph paper. Every document was neatly recorded, every word legible. The notebook contained vital details about aircraft design, speed, radio frequencies, weapons, avionics, radars, a look at blueprints still on the drawing boards, and a glimpse of planes that would not be flying for a decade. Gilcher's two meetings with Tolkachev had been productive, but the men had not engaged in the kind of free-flowing conversation that would reveal Tolkachev's motives or thinking in any depth. Gilcher was hungry for more. In the long letter Tolkachev handed to him on April 4th, there were tantalizing hints that Tolkachev was a strong and unwavering personality, a person who took the long view. In the letter, Tolkachev laid out a plan to spy for the United States for 12 years in 7 stages. He described what materials he would provide and when. It was an extraordinary blueprint and a declaration of his seriousness. Tolkachev said his goal was to damage the Soviet Union to the maximum extent possible. "I have selected a course which does not permit me to move backwards, and I have no intention of veering from this course," he wrote. "Since I have tasked myself with passing the maximum amount of information, I do not intend to stop halfway." Another clue to his personality, Gilcher saw, was Tolkachev's stubborn and determined effort to contact an American, which he now revealed in some detail to the CIA in his long letter. "The idea to pass a note by a car or in a car did not come at once," he wrote. "At first, I tried to find out if it was possible to establish communications at exhibits in which the USA participated. This turned out to be difficult, since the exhibits are relatively rare, and there are always many people present." Then he went on solitary walks around central Moscow. He had spotted a car with a license plate D04526, the 04 indicating it was driven by Americans. This led him to decide to make contact by sliding a note through an open car window or talking to the driver. "At first," Tolkachev recalled, "I naively thought that it is only necessary to select a convenient moment to come up to the car, to request a conversation, and that I will be welcomed with open arms." He added, "I started to search for a place where one could approach a car. Thus started my purposeful walks along the streets of Moscow and along Devyatinsky Lane that lasted many days and many hours." This was the small street along the edge of the embassy compound where he had approached Hathaway. Tolkachev had memorized a few sentences in English, just in case he encountered an American. Finally, he saw the car with the D04526 license plate at the gas station on Krasina Ulitsa, a street just blocks from his apartment building, on that cold evening in January 1977. "The moment was suitable," he recalled. "Deserted. At that moment, there were no Soviet and no socialist bloc cars at the gas station." He approached Fulton and repeated the English phrases he had memorized, including the question he asked Fulton. "Are you American? I would like to talk to you." On hearing Fulton's rebuff, "I passed a note and quickly departed." After dropping the note, Tolkachev recalled, he expected events to unfold rapidly, but nothing happened for months. He kept trying over and over again, but was getting nowhere. The more Gilcher learned of Tolkachev's story, the more he could sense this was a driven man. What propelled him was not entirely clear, but Tolkachev was not a casual walk-in. He was dogged and resolute. Tolkachev also displayed an engineer's exactitude. In his letter to the CIA, he wrote a precise account of how secret documents were handled at his institute. He drew hand sketches to illustrate it. Secret documents were kept in the first departments, in two separate buildings. Tolkachev called them buildings 1 and 2, located on sketch 4. He described how an employee could receive a secret document at any time during the working day and keep it all day. The document would have to be returned by 5 p.m. As a result, he added, it is possible to leave the institute for 1.5 or 2 hours during the course of the day with a secret document. This must, of course, be done illegally, for example, under an overcoat, raincoat, or suit jacket. Naturally, only documents of small size can be taken out in this manner. It was prohibited to bring a briefcase into the building, and shopping bags were checked at random, but often. A separate, classified library held the top-secret scientific studies and dissertations. Tolkachev wrote, I can make use of all the materials in the secret library. Thus, both the first department and the library held classified materials. Tolkachev had identified a gaping hole in the security cordon. He could simply walk out of the institute with the documents in his coat pocket. Gilcher had twice used dead drops to communicate with the spy, but now he learned that Tolkachev's patience was running thin. Tolkachev said it was getting hard to explain at home why he had to run out after each phone call. Tolkachev appealed to Gilcher, saying that, psychologically, it would be better for him if they just accepted the risk and met each other periodically in person, not fooling around by stashing a dirty construction mitten behind a phone booth, where it might be found by a stranger. This was another sign of Tolkachev's unflinching personality. If he was going to risk his life in espionage, he wanted to know and meet the person for whom he was putting himself in such danger. The impersonal dead drop gave him no chance for such contact. Then, Tolkachev made one more request. He asked the CIA for a lethal cyanide pill to commit suicide in case he was discovered. This was known at the CIA as an L pill. The L stood for lethal. The L pill had been issued to Ogorodnik 2 years earlier, and he used it to commit suicide soon after his arrest. Gilcher realized that winning CIA headquarters approval for supplying one to Tolkachev was going to be very difficult. There were always fears at headquarters that an agent would panic and take the suicide pill unnecessarily, or that it would be discovered and betray the spy. On May 1st, headquarters cabled, As we have on previous occasions, we would like to stall on this question. The cable suggested it would be best for Gilcher to deflect the request in person at the next meeting with Tolkachev. Gilcher wrote back on May 4th that he agreed, and every effort will be made to stall on this question. On May 7th, headquarters offered Gilcher talking points to discourage Tolkachev. A. The mental burden of having this item on his person at all times. B. The problem of concealment. C. The risk of premature use of the item through misjudgment of an actual situation. D. The possession of this item closes all options available in case of apprehension by authorities, even for extraneous reasons. Gilcher now had a sketchy impression of Tolkachev, someone who was committed to espionage, had access to secret documents, with the organized and precise mindset of an engineer. But Tolkachev's requests and desires would test the outer bounds of espionage in Moscow. The CIA felt that the personal meetings that Tolkachev wanted were the riskiest method of all. Just being seen with a foreigner on the street could spell trouble if spotted by a trained KGB surveillance team. Tolkachev's demands for more money were unsettling. His special request, the L pill, carried the risk of a fatal misjudgment. Still, Gilcher concluded that Tolkachev was a solid, straightforward person. someone they could work with. Chapter 6. Six Figures. In his long April letter to the CIA, Tolkachev wrote disdainfully of Soviet ideology and public life. He said that politics, literature, and philosophy had been enmeshed for a long time in such an impassable, hypocritical demagoguery and ideological empty talk that he tried to ignore them. Tolkachev said he hadn't been to a theater in a long time. Although he enjoyed classics, contemporary Soviet plays were full of ideological gibberish. It was a common attitude. On the street, the party's grand declarations were etched into the concrete facades of metro stations and factory gates, giant banners of self-congratulations. But to most Soviet citizens of the late 1970s, the promises of a bright communist future were long forgotten. These were the years of stagnation. The Soviet Union devoted such enormous resources to the arms race that its economy sputtered out only the most shoddy goods for consumers. Shortages were frequent and annoying. People waited in lines for hours to get shoes or a winter coat. Tolkachev's high-rise apartment building at 1 Ploshchad Vostaniya, one of Moscow's seven distinctive spired towers, had been constructed in 1955, with four high-ceilinged food shops at the street level, one on each corner for meat, fish, dairy, and bread. Modeled on an elegant turn-of-the-century Russian gastronome in Moscow, the four shops were resplendent with red and white inlaid marble, floor-to-ceiling windows, luminescent chandeliers, and mighty central columns. The goods had never been bountiful, but in the years after the shops were built, it was possible to just walk in and find smoked fish and sausage. By 1979, the stores were in decay, the shelves nearly empty. Theoretically, the Soviet state provided for almost everything: medical care, schooling, transportation, work. But the system was rotting from within. The shortages forced many people to deal in a vast shadow economy, struggling to survive through friends and connections, always on the lookout for a tin of meat, some good tea, or a delivery of shoes. Tolkachev's work at the Institute offered him some privileges that buffered the misery and drudgery. Once a week, he was entitled to purchase a zakaz, a modest food ration distributed at the office, perhaps a can of instant coffee, or scarce tea, and maybe even a smoked sausage. But he was not part of the pampered elite. He did not belong to the Communist Party, kept to himself, and had become something of an ascetic. He did not own a car, nor a country house, or dacha, when he first volunteered to the CIA. He was at the mercy of the shadow economy for such things as medicine and clothing. On weekends or after work, he and his wife would search for goods in stores and markets. In a small crawl space in his apartment, he hoarded building materials, boards, plywood, and pipes for small projects. He enjoyed working with his hands. He repaired his own radio and television. For relaxation, he much preferred camping trips, alone with his family, in the rugged wilderness of forest and lakes, than a free pass offered by the Institute to a crowded state-run resort at Sochi, on the Black Sea. When it came to things he wanted, Tolkachev's primary focus was his son Oleg, who was 14 years old in 1979. Tolkachev did everything he could for him. Surrounded by empty shelves and stores, young people in the Soviet Union had developed a hunger for consumer goods. They were influenced by what they learned and heard about the West. They prized rock music and were desperate for a pair of denim jeans. The Soviet Central Planning System had totally neglected denim jeans and later only came up with cheap imitations. But they could be found in the shadow economy, from street hustlers or from overseas travelers. Oleg possessed a creative and artistic bent, and he sought out Western rock music. Tolkachev didn't lack money. He earned 250 rubles a month, plus a 40% security bonus, or about 350 rubles. His wife's salary doubled this. At the time, the average Soviet pay was some 120 rubles a month. But money could not buy goods that did not exist. The Russian language has a verb meaning to get, which was used more commonly at the time than to buy. What you could get often depended not on money, but on connections, or on the chance that a scarce thing became available unexpectedly. For a while, there was no tea, and then it would suddenly appear. This was the world that Tolkachev knew, a party state that congratulated itself on its greatness, but that had over decades become a dystopia. When Gilsha read over Tolkachev's April letter, one section stood out. Tolkachev expressed irritation at the CIA's proposals for paying him. Gilsha's offer of 1,000 rubles a month was distressing. Hardly enough, Tolkachev wrote. He wanted much more as a sign of the significance and the importance of my work and my labor. He promised Gilsha that he would not be reckless. He lamented, "To the present day, I have not felt adequate valuation of my lonely efforts to break down the wall of mistrust, and also the significance of the information reported by me in 1978. Gilsha knew it was true, but he also knew the CIA was right to be cautious. They could lose the spy by rewarding him with cash while his neighbors were stuck in a daily life of shadows and shortages. Even Hathaway, the station chief, had doubts.
"What the hell is he going to do with all that money?"
Hathaway often asked Gilsha.
"Put it up in his attic and sit there with his feet in it?"
Tolkachev, however, was stubborn. He at first asked for 10,000 rubles, and later 40,000 to 50,000 rubles, for the secrets he had already provided. He insisted that in the future he be paid handsomely, in dollars. He demanded at least the same dollar amount as the pilot Belenko had received when he flew the Soviet MiG-25 to Japan in 1976. Tolkachev said he heard on a Voice of America broadcast that it was six figures. He, too, wanted six figures. On May 1, 1979, headquarters sent a cable to Gilsha and Hathaway outlining a new plan for paying Tolkachev a six-figure salary. "We are prepared in principle to offer him a total of $300,000, the cable reported. But because it would be impossible for Tolkachev to store that much cash in Moscow, headquarters proposed putting the money in an interest-bearing account in the West, in either Tolkachev's name or someone else's name, or perhaps opening the account with $100,000 and paying him $50,000 a year for the next 4 years. The cable raised another possibility. Since money is obviously not the only motivation, i.e. his comments about needing a pat on the back, we wonder if some other form of commendation is not in order," the cable said. "We have in mind perhaps a medal, membership in our organization, and/or a certificate of appreciation. Would any of these rewards be psychologically effective to our cause?" When Gilsha drafted the ops note he would give Tolkachev at their next meeting, set for June, he made sure to include a "well done" pat on the back. But over the next few weeks, the uncertainty deepened at headquarters about giving Tolkachev so much money. On May 18th, Turner, the director of Central Intelligence, who had harbored such deep skepticism about human sources, approved giving Tolkachev $100,000 for his cooperation to date, and, "as a symbol of our good faith," while spreading payments over 5 years instead of four, Turner's decision, relayed to Moscow in a cable from headquarters, added a condition: "assuming his production continues." Gilsha felt all the hand-wringing at headquarters was senseless. Tolkachev had not been a reluctant spy. He had proposed a seven-stage plan for espionage over a dozen years and seemed hell-bent on carrying it out. On May 22nd, Gilsha shot back to headquarters that the offer does not dovetail with Tolkachev's desires. Linking the pay to his continuing production was foolish, he said, since CK's fear's principal motivation is not money. He added that Tolkachev preferred an open-ended arrangement, while the headquarters plan would end after 5 years. Gilshear suggested that Tolkachev be offered the $100,000 and then $40,000 a year, without conditions. Gilshear hammered away at the financial details, doing everything possible to deepen Tolkachev's trust on the one hand, and deal with the concerns of headquarters on the other. Gilshear wrote to Tolkachev in the ops note for their next meeting that the CIA would pay him $300,000, but the agency was worried about how to deliver it and where to put all the money. Gilshear proposed the CIA would open a savings account for Tolkachev in the West, pay him 8.75% interest a year, allow him to make withdrawals, and show him the passbook every time they met. Gilshear also suggested compensation by some sort of valuables besides money. In late May 1979, a handful of American intelligence experts, mostly specialists on Soviet weapons systems, gathered for a seminar in Washington in a high-security conference room. The attendees came from the Air Force, the Navy, the CIA, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. They had each read the 100-page secret report circulated in April, describing the materials in Tolkachev's handwritten notebook passed to Gilshear on that freezing cold New Year's Day. The time had come to address the hard question. Was Tolkachev's information genuine? The purpose of the seminar was to scrub his material for any signs of disinformation. 2.5 years had passed since Tolkachev's first approach at the Moscow gas station, yet the intelligence agencies and the military still harbored skepticism. If Tolkachev was under the control of the KGB, if his documents were fabricated in order to send the United States off in the wrong direction, it would be calamitous to take the bait. The danger was certainly real. The KGB had a long history of skillfully using deception, disinformation, and misdirection. The United States had used the same methods against the Soviet Union. At the same time, the United States was eager for insight and intelligence about Soviet military plans and intentions. If Tolkachev's access was real and his documents genuine, the payoff could be handsome. Blueprints and research files from the most advanced laboratories in the Soviet military-industrial complex. The United States enjoyed an advantage over the Soviet Union in weapons technology, but there was always a fear of surprise by the other side. The spy could provide early warning about Soviet weapons development years in the future. After the seminar was over, a brief summary was cabled by headquarters to Gilshear and Hathaway in Moscow. The summary reported that Tolkachev's documents, notes, and drawings offered a revealing glimpse into the long closed world of Soviet military planning. All participants reported that they were impressed with the product, to the extent that all checkable information is considered logical, the summary reported. There is no factual statement that can be refuted. You will be pleased to know that C.K. Sphere's product provided the frame to pull together all the bits and pieces of apparent extraneous information collected heretofore, so that a complete picture can now be made of Soviet advancement in this particular field. It is estimated that the product has saved us 5 years of R&D time. The specific field of Soviet advancement referred to here is not known precisely, but was probably avionics and radars, including look-down, shoot-down, as this was Tolkachev's area. At that moment, the Defense Department's annual total budget for research and development, testing, and engineering was more than $12 billion, most of it for the Air Force and the Navy to confront the Soviet threat with new and modernized weapons. By saving 5 years of spending, Tolkachev, in his first major delivery to Gilshear, had passed documents worth at least millions of dollars to the United States, and likely much more. The experts at the seminar were enthusiastic enough to draw up more questions to be passed to Tolkachev at the next meeting. Hathaway recalled that when Tolkachev's materials arrived at headquarters, people went wild. The military said, "Good God, where did you get that? Let's have more of it." In Moscow, Gilscher was getting ready for the upcoming rendezvous in June. "As you well understand," Gilscher wrote to Tolkachev, "your information is of critical interest to us, and the small group of officials at the highest levels who are aware of your work has asked me to extend their highest appreciation for your work, their highest esteem for you personally, and an assurance that your product is of the highest value." Gilscher knew that Tolkachev was taking huge risks, and reassured him that "your information, due to its very sensitive nature, is receiving very limited distribution under the highest classification, and is only seen by the specialists who have the need to see it." The 100-page summary of Tolkachev's intelligence had been printed in only 7 copies, kept under tight security. The names of those who saw the intelligence were recorded on a registry known as a bigot list, stored with the reports and requirements staff of the CIA's Soviet division. When it was translated and distributed, the Tolkachev material was often blended with other intelligence from other sources from the Soviet Union, so if there was a leak, Tolkachev could not be fingered as the source. When sending cables from Moscow, the station routinely encrypted them. But in the case of Tolkachev, extra precautions were taken. Any identifying information, such as names, ages, locations, or physical characteristics in the cables, was double encrypted. For example, a mention of Oleg would be changed to Alex before the cable was fully scrambled for transmission to headquarters. At Langley, the cable was unscrambled and the proper names or words put back in. That way, if the KGB had managed to intercept the cable, they still would not have a name or clue leading them to the agent's identity. Only a handful of people at headquarters knew the true identity of C.K. Sphere. On June 6th, Gilscher met Tolkachev face-to-face for the third time. When Gilscher spotted him, Tolkachev was wearing a dark tan raincoat with a yellow and brown plaid shirt. After they exchanged paroles, a phrase known only to each of them, such as "Boris sends regards," Tolkachev gave Gilscher 29 pages of handwritten notes and 10 exposed film cassettes from the Molly miniature camera. When they talked, Gilscher asked about Tolkachev's health, recalling that he mentioned in his April letter that he suffered from leg pains, mostly in his shins, diagnosed as thrombophlebitis. Tolkachev replied there had been a misunderstanding. It was his wife who had the ailment. She had been treated at the local clinic with compresses and some ointment, but Tolkachev wanted to know if the CIA could come up with something more effective. It was just another small glimpse of the world of shadows and shortages in which Tolkachev lived every day. Gilscher gave Tolkachev some advice he'd been sent from headquarters about treatments. Gilscher then gave Tolkachev the ops note he had written, a list of questions or requirements from U.S. experts, a schedule for future meetings, and a Pentax ME single-lens reflex 35mm camera and lens for copying documents, with a clamp to fasten it steady to a chair or table. Gilscher went out of his way to explain the details about money. The CIA would maintain a dollar savings account with interest and give Tolkachev a 6-figure salary, as he had requested. Gilscher pointed out that it was better to be paid in dollars than in rubles. The dollars were safe, compared with rubles, which could be lost in periodic currency confiscations and devaluations in the Soviet Union. Tolkachev's reaction was noncommittal. Gilscher observed that Tolkachev always kept his cool. On this day, he was absolutely unreadable. Tolkachev mentioned to Gilscher, almost as an afterthought, that he didn't know what to do with all the money anyway. Gilscher handed him another 5,000 rubles. They were together only 15 minutes. On June 18, 1979, President Jimmy Carter signed the SALT II Strategic Arms Treaty with the Soviet General Secretary Leonid Brezhnev at the conclusion of a 3-day summit in Vienna. Carter had come into office brimming with idealism about nuclear arms control, but by 1979, all he could manage was a treaty that barely slowed the arms race. During the negotiations for SALT II, the Soviets repeatedly expressed alarm about a new weapon being developed by the United States, the Strategic Cruise Missile, a pilotless projectile carrying a miniature nuclear warhead that could fly high over hostile territory, then swoop down to 50 feet above ground level and steer toward its target with a sophisticated, terrain-sensitive guidance system. The Soviet Union did not have effective radars at low altitude, a gap in air defenses it had simply been unable to close. This vulnerability was one of the most important subjects in Tolkachev's reporting. In a White House meeting during the President Ford years, Undersecretary of Defense William Clements had once informed the President, "Our cruise missile projects drive them up the wall because their defense will not protect them from our cruise missiles, and they know it. Cruise missiles cause them plenty of pain and agony." By the third year of Carter's presidency, the American cruise missile was fast becoming a reality. On July 17th, a month after Carter signed the treaty with Brezhnev, a Tomahawk cruise missile successfully flew its first free flight test by General Dynamics, which was locked in competition with Boeing to build the new weapons system. The cruise missile didn't fly as fast as an intercontinental ballistic missile, but it was sneaky and nearly unstoppable. Secret tests by the U.S. military completed in September 1978 showed that current Soviet air defenses were ineffective against it. Still, there was one nagging uncertainty. What were the Soviets going to do about it? Tolkachev's notes and film from the June 6th meeting with Gilscher were sent back to headquarters. The notes were translated, and by June 25th, the details were on the desk of George T. Kolaris, chief of the Soviet division. Kolaris was a tall man with a commanding presence, who had spent most of his career in the clandestine service as an operations officer, working in Greece, Indonesia, Laos, the Philippines, and Brazil. He had won special admiration for acquiring a warhead and operational manual for a Soviet SA-2 anti-aircraft missile in Indochina. He knew the perils and stress of espionage operations. Later, he had been brought in to clean up the counterintelligence staff after Angleton's reign of paranoia. Then, in 1976, Kolaris was put in charge of the Soviet division. Direct in manner and conversation, he inspired confidence in those who worked with him. The moment he got the notes from Tolkachev, Kolaris realized they were something extraordinary. Despite all the Soviet complaints about the U.S. cruise missile, Tolkachev reported that Moscow's defense planners and weapons designers had just started to study the problem of how to respond. Just started. This would give the United States breathing room and confidence that the weapons system could be effective for years to come. Immediately, Kolaris wrote a note to Turner, the CIA director, and the two deputy directors, describing Gilscher's meeting in Moscow, the handoff of notes, and the 10 exposed film cassettes. CK's fears information continues to receive the highest evaluation, he wrote. In addition to the intelligence on the cruise missile, Tolkachev's notes contained information on a new surface-to-air missile system and confirmed CIA reports that the Soviets were building a new identification system for military units. All of this will impact upcoming national estimates, Kolaris said, referring to the CIA's most important finished intelligence reports for policymakers in government. On the document routing sheet, Kolaris asked that his note be kept out of the regular filing system. The fewer people to see it, the better. He asked that it be hand-carried to Turner and the two deputy directors. One of them scribbled a single word on the routing sheet. Fabulous. Chapter 7. Spy Camera. Tolkachev had access to extremely sensitive and secret documents, but it wasn't going to be worth much to the CIA if he could not copy them. At first, he memorized what he saw and wrote the texts by hand into a notebook. But that was not practical for larger quantities over the dozen years he envisioned spying. His ability to copy documents without being detected was the linchpin to everything he and the CIA wanted to accomplish. The first camera the CIA had given him for copying materials was the miniature Molly, but it was not the CIA's best equipment. Headquarters informed the Moscow station on July 4, 1979, that the 10 cassettes passed by Tolkachev to Gilshear were basically unreadable, except for a handful of legible pages. The reason was poor focus and movement while Tolkachev was holding the tiny camera. This was a frustrating setback, not only for the loss of 800 frames of documents, but for the larger doubts it raised about the Tolkachev operation. Tolkachev could not simply step into a back room at his institute and make photocopies. The Soviet authorities had long feared copiers. At its most basic, the machine helped spread information, and strict control of information was central to the Communist Party's grip on power. In most offices, photocopy machines were kept under lock and key. A copying machine is located in a special room and operated by 4 or 5 employees, Tolkachev wrote to the CIA of the situation at his workplace. Entry to the copying room is not allowed to persons not working there. Secret documents would have to be submitted for copying by the First Department, while any worker could send in unclassified documents. But he added, before an unclassified document can be submitted to the copying department, an order must be filled out. This form must include a certification by the First Department concerning the classification of the document, i.e., a certification that the document is not classified. In these documents, there can be no word or phrase revealing the nature of the enterprise or institute. For example, the First Department would not allow the following sentence. The radar station has several work modes. The sentence would have to be changed to the following form. Item 4003 has several work modes. From Tolkachev's note, it was obvious that photocopies were not an option. The CIA would have to rely on cameras and film. When spying for the CIA and the British in the early 1960s, Penkovsky had relied on the commercially available Minox Model 3 camera, which was also widely used by the KGB and other intelligence services. The camera was 3.2 inches long, 1.1 inches wide, and only 0.6 inch deep, small enough to fit in the palm of a man's hand with a four-element lens that could focus closely. The Minox was excellent for photographing documents, letters, pages of books, and envelopes, but could not be easily used without others noticing. The shutter was noisy. It required two hands and proper lighting. Not the best for covert photography. Penkovsky's arrest was due in part to a lack of sophisticated technology for espionage. After-action reports underscored the absence of effective gear for the operation, particularly in agent communications.
There simply were no suitable devices on agency shelves for this type of operation, recalled Robert Wallace and H. Keith Melton in an authoritative history of CIA spycraft. For instance, as late as 1962, the CIA had yet to develop a small, reliable document copy camera for agents. But technology exploded in the years that followed.
By 1970, the CIA's experts had begun working on an extremely small and quiet camera. The requirements were almost unimaginable. It had to be able to work effectively inside a KGB office without being detected. That became an urgent need when the CIA recruited Ogorodnik in Colombia in 1973. Under tight security, the agency hired a precision optical contractor to build a tiny camera, designated T-100, just 1/6 the size of the Minox, with a small cylindrical shape that could be concealed in such everyday items as pens, cigarette lighters, or key fobs. The camera was a jewel of watchmaking mechanical precision and optical miniaturization, wrote Wallace and Melton. The lens was made up of 8 minuscule ground glass elements, exactingly stacked one on top of the other.